Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1098.GN1403, certificate number 44008. The Salton Sea.
This is a show that we have threatened to do since the very beginning of the Omnibus.
I think it came up in Water Wars, right?
It came up in Water Wars
early on. Which is the eighth show.
Yeah, it came up quite a bit in the Slab City show.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
I can't remember what the connection is. Maybe you'll tell me.
Yeah. Well, the connection is that the Slab City and the Salton Sea are very close to one another. And part of the same desert ecosystem, both of the actual desert ecosystem and also the ecosystem of total kooks and far out weirdos and freaks that live out in that part of the world.
A cultural ecosystem.
A cultural ecosystem as well as an actual ecosystem. But it at one level, it doesn't make any sense that you and I, two dyed-in-the-wool Northwesterners, should give one good hoot about what happens down there in Southern California. Am I right?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Unless things get so bad down there that they all come up here.
That's right.
That's what you don't
That's
want.
What we don't want. Also, you fly down to Los Angeles all the time now. You're kind of a half Los Angelino.
I would say I'm not half.
Maybe how much? 10%? 15%? 8%?
Well, I'm much more than I was.
Yeah.
Because I used to kind of dislike LA in a lot of ways. And now I found there are parts of it I don't mind. Usually my visits to LA were such that I would just be in traffic for a third of it or more.
And now the parts of LA you like are the parts that are within a 3-block radius of the studio where you record.
I mean, weirdly, Culver City is kind of nice now.
That is weird.
It's its own little walkable downtown it's got an Erewhon and it's about to have a Shake Shack.
I know. I was very surprised at the strollability of Culver City the last time I was
there. And even COVID, like more outdoor dining. There's live music all the time. There's this, mostly it's Amazon moving in. Amazon and Apple now have outposts there.
They're such great contributors to the street culture of towns.
They're good neighbors. That's what you want to say about Amazon.
The world is upside down.
So I enjoy LA a lot more than I used to. And not just LA proper, but there's parts of the valley I like. But still, I'm only there, 5 days a month, tops. That in my Mbialik's busiest months, I'm still only there 5 days or no more.
How often do you get over the pass into Palm Springs, Coachella, Joshua Tree?
I've only been to Palm Springs once, and I've never actually seen Joshua Tree. I've never been to the national park. I mean, do you recommend it?
Oh, Joshua Tree is phenomenal. And Joshua Tree is experiencing a lot of growth and change right now because, I mean, it's always been kind of a place for people from LA to go, kind of put their cowboy hats on and eat barbecue and then make it home by the end of the day. But Joshua Tree during the pandemic, I think, became a place where a lot of people just decamped to those little cabins and shacks up there.
I have a Jeopardy coworker who lives out there.
Yeah.
Opens his door and sees nothing but desert.
A lot of that happened. And then maybe it's not too much of a stretch to say that the kind of wellness universe of people seeking.
Are there amazing energies there, John?
The energies are so.
Tell me about the vortex there.
The energies are so strong. You know, there are giant cyclotrons and crystal pyramids out there.
Let's say Sedona is a 10, mm-hmm. and I don't know what's a 1 in this scenario. Everett Washington is okay. a 1.
Everett is a 1.
How good are the energy vortices out by
They're a 14 at least.
Whoa.
Yeah. Joshua Tree's not like any other place. And you could be forgiven for going there and thinking, I don't want to live here. There's no water here, and this doesn't have, there's nothing here.
Is that a common misconception?
It's a common misconception that you don't want to live there. It's, you know, it's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It has all the things that a person might not want. Flash floods, lots of hicks. There's a marine base, a Marine Corps base not far away down on the other side of the valley. Yeah, the big one.
Do you think, is that why U2 went to Joshua Tree? Were they thinking of joining the Marines?
Me too? Or you're talking about the band U2?
The band U2, not yours truly also.
No, the band U2 went there during their cowboy hat phase because it's...
Because they were going bald. Well, the Edge was going bald, and so they had to go to some place where cowboy hats were acceptable.
It's maybe the closest place to Los Angeles that you can wear a cowboy hat and a turquoise necklace. Mm. A lot of times you can wear one and not the other. You can do both in Joshua Tree. But Joshua Tree is really blowing up now, just as Palm Springs and the Coachella Valley are.
I'm not going to Coachella.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
Really? What if they offered you $1 million to get your band back together?
Oh, I thought you meant to headline.
Yeah. I think
that's a you scenario. Coachella offers you $1 million to get your band back together.
That's not going
to happen. I don't know what I'm going to do.
I might be invited to join a band on stage that got offered $1 million to reform the band. But even that, pretty unlikely.
I missed Beyonce. I don't know what point there would be in going to Coachella now.
Maybe you could do a duet with an AI Snoop Dogg after Snoop Dogg dies. I'd love to. I'm just picturing it.
I think I would send my hologram instead.
Oh, right. So it's Snoop Dogg is alive and you appear as a hologram.
Yeah.
Going, Snoop Dogg.
And I'm actually there. I just didn't want to leave the hotel.
They're filming your hologram from the
hotel.
That's
right. Yeah. I'm in the bath.
All of those places were like so many places in the U.S. I mean, you could buy a house in Palm Springs for not very much money, not that long ago. And now it's all changed. And it's work from home, but it's also just the people leaving LA and weirdly heading to places with less water. Although Palm Springs, it's right there in the name.
Is there a spring?
There's a lot of water in Palm Springs.
Huh.
Natural water that comes up from the ground and flows down from the hills, and it's pretty wet.
A lot of gay folks of a certain generation have kind of remade Palm Springs.
That was the popular, it was a popular gay destination for a long time, and that's still true, but like anything, like any cool...
Like any cool gayborhood.
Any cool gayborhood or subculture, it's just being, you know, diluted.
But now that generation that used to enjoy going there on weekends is retiring, I wonder if a lot of them are going to wind up there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always going to be a place that you want to sit around by the swimming pool. People forget that in the summer, the average temperature or the mean temperature in Palm Springs is 1,200 degrees.
I think that's actually, that's like for 10 years old. You know, that's...
Oh, that's an old statistic?
Yeah.
It's
that's
now
pre-global warming.
5,000 degrees?
Yeah, it's now, it starts with a 2 now.
You can't even breathe the air in the summer, but it's wonderful in November to March. But I think... And I'm now speaking just briefly. This is a brief aside to our international listeners and people that don't, A, use imperial measurements, and B, don't really care about the geography of the United States or of California. Too bad for you, this show.
It's not the metric valley, it's the imperial valley.
This show is going to be a lot about a lot of those things. There's an amazing geographic feature of the United States that we call the Great Basin. Mm. And you, when you were going
to live there,
you were living in Salt Lake. That's part of the Great Basin. And the Great Basin, by its name, you would think that it was just a big valley. But of course, the Great Basin contains...
Weirdly, it has mountains.
It contains not only mountains, but the highest point in the continental United States and all of... Except for the mountains of Washington and Alaska.
Now, John, imagine for a moment. Your face and your hands are dirty.
Yes.
You need a basin.
Yes.
You decide to wash up in a basin. What would you think if you're washing up at that basin and the basin has incredibly high mountains running down the middle of it?
I would say, who named this geographic feature?
I would say this basin sucks and I'm going to get a new, or I'm never staying at this hotel again.
This basin sucks. The Great Basin is an enormous area that encompasses almost all of the state of Nevada, the larger part of the state of Utah, even part of southern Wyoming and southern Oregon, and a lot of Southern California. And what it is an area that none of the water from that area has any outlet to the sea.
It can't escape.
And that's an area with a tremendous snowfall in winter. There's a ton of water there. And just geographically, there's no river that would take the water from Salt Lake to the ocean.
Used to be a big lake, right? It's largely a dry lake bed.
Well, except for the parts that are 14,000 foot mountains or higher.
I guess those would have been islands.
So, I mean, that's why there is a Great Salt Lake.
For now.
For now, right? And there have traditionally, you know, and I'm talking about over the course of 6 million years, lots of giant lakes, and all of the water produced in this enormous Great Basin either evaporates in the summer or sinks into underground aquifers or, you know, goes and replenishes these, you know, there are still many, many lakes. Lake Tahoe is in the Great Basin.
When I was in Northern California last week, somebody told me that there's currently a lake bigger than Lake Tahoe right now because of this year's snowmelt that was not a lake like a year ago.
Yeah.
It was just a field or a meadow or a pasture. Now it's a lake bigger than Tahoe because of the crazy snowmelt they had in the Sierras.
I mean, all of Central California was seasonal lakes. All the area around Sacramento, big swampy swamps, and all of those reservoirs that even a year ago we looked at with like apocalyptic horror at the fact that like the reservoirs up around Mount Shasta were down where you could see all the dead bodies and all the old rusty cars. And now the water level is right back up to like the top level they've ever been just because of this past year. Phenomenal.
I don't think it's sustainable, but it's nice for them after a decade of drought worries.
Yeah. What's a tragedy is that there's still a bunch of snow in the mountains, even as we're recording this, and there's no place to keep that water because all the reservoirs are full. And so it's all going down the LA River, right out into the sea and Sacramento River. You know, we have not built an infrastructure to actually hold that water to fill the bathtubs of all of the TV stars that fly down there to do their game shows.
Well, maybe that's the way to do it. If you can't build a reservoir, just get everybody in LA to fill their bathtub.
Oh, good idea.
And then drink that all summer.
Drink your bathtub water all summer.
That's a great, is that your graduation speech? Drink your bathtub water all summer.
Graduates, I have one thing to say to you. As we discussed in the Water Wars episode, a lot of the water that has been used to fuel the explosive growth, both of agriculture and of population in the desert Southwest and in particular Southern California, is taken from underground aquifers, but then manipulated and rerouted to those places from other sources, and in particular the Colorado River. And the Colorado River is the river south of the Great Basin that drains all of eastern Colorado, all of the Rockies, you know, in the sort of in Colorado, and then down through the desert Southwest. And it traditionally went into the Gulf of Mexico. Moved south.
I like how it's a tradition.
It's a tradition.
It's a thing it liked to do in its family was to flow into the Gulf of Mexico.
Although the Colorado River has some different traditions,
for example, within
its culture. But
none of us are monoliths, John.
In recent centuries, it turned south through Mexico and had this incredible delta, sort of swampy delta region that was...
Was it a rich, teeming wetlands?
Ken, let me tell you about the rich teeming wetlands.
My favorite thing the wetlands do is teem.
Do you want to hear about some diversity of plant and sea life and birds.
Now, famously, John, I love all kinds of diversity.
Yes, I know you do.
One of them, ecodiversity.
Ecodiversity is what it used to have. But the Colorado River, you know, like a great many rivers, has done a lot of things in its life.
We've all made mistakes.
And the Colorado River in ancient times, the Gulf of California went all the way up to the very top of that Coachella Imperial Valley. The Gulf of California went all the way up to the mountains.
It would look weird on a map to see Baja extending that far north,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Like suddenly the Gulf of California gets an episiotomy, and suddenly it's jabbing up there into the mountains.
Yeah, it would have gone, you know, all the way up to Indio.
I remember early, I've probably talked about this on the show, but a lot of early maps make the mistake of assuming it goes all the way to basically San Francisco Bay, and that Southern California is an island.
Yeah, right.
California was long believed to be an island.
The Colorado River, you know, changed its course quite a bit over time, and the delta brought so much silt down with it that the silt of the delta actually ended up being the thing that separated the valley from the ocean. The silt clogged the
original outflow.
The outflow. And gradually built up, and then the Colorado, as the mouth of the Colorado would shift, sometimes it would pour into the valley and create a big sort of brackish lake.
And help me picture this. It's kind of at the top of the Gulf of California today.
So it would be all of where Coachella, Palm Springs, all of that would have been part of an enormous lake. And for those listening, the Joshua Tree that we were referring to is up high above Palm Springs. It's up in a mountainous area, close by car, but far in terms of ecosystem. And the pass from Los Angeles to this inner valley is called San Gorgonio Pass. It's a 2,600-foot pass. It's the place where, if you see any movie like Less Than Zero set in Palm Springs, I don't know if Less Than Zero was set in Palm Springs. I have a vague memory of that movie. Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, does some terrible things.
Is it Palm Springs?
If you go over that pass, that's where you see those giant wind farms. It's one of the windiest places in the continental U.S. and the big, big windmills that are outside of L.A. are in that pass. And that whole valley is part of the San Andreas Fault system, which when we were kids was one of those Bigfoot Loch Ness monster things where there was going to be an earthquake on the San Andreas Fault and all of California was going to slide into
It's true.
Sea.
And we weren't even California kids, but yeah. I remember, the San Andreas Fault, maybe because of the first Superman movie.
We talked about it a lot. It was a thing, maybe if a nuclear bomb went off there, it was going to set off the giant earthquake.
To this day, I don't think I can name a single other fault, including the one that's going to level Seattle.
Uh-huh.
Whatever that's called.
It's the Seattle Fault or the San Juan de Fuca Fault.
I thought the Seattle Fault was what they called the Seattle process.
That's true, right.
But the San Andreas Fault looms large in my...
And I think during that period of time, during the 1970s, there was a lot of interest in geologic stuff anyway. I think even plate tectonics was fairly new and realizing that all of the...
We're old.
Yeah, all of the roads in this part of the country that suddenly had like a small deviation in the center line. You're like, where did that come from?
Why are they all in the same direction?
Oh, it's a fault line. Yeah, we talked about it a lot. And one of the threats of the San Andreas Fault was that it was going to open up that valley to seawater and the ocean was going to pour in. And that is what was going to make Southern California an island.
And new beachfront property for Lex Luthor.
All of this is not that far from reality.
Really?
This trough of this area that has been at various times an inland sea, a giant sort of brackish freshwater
Delta,
lake.
Yeah.
It's only 115 miles long, and it's called the Salton Sink, and at its lowest point, it's 236 feet below sea level, which, by comparison, Death Valley is only 282 feet below sea level. So it's the second lowest point in the United States, and 260 or 236 feet below sea level, that's considerably below sea level. That's not just an incidental amount below sea level.
That's almost as low as you can get.
Well, no, the Dead Sea is 1,400 feet below
sea level. I assumed the Dead Sea was going to be slightly lower.
1,400 feet. I just visited the Dead Sea.
Did you swim?
I did swim.
Or bob on the surface, I guess.
It's very hard. I did not enjoy it, frankly, because you think, oh, I'm going to float. But what it did was, for the first time in my life, it brought my legs and hips up to the surface. And I felt like it was basically forcing my head
right
down into the water in a way that I couldn't just sit there and tread water and bob. So I actually was treading water, but in order to keep my feet down,
yeah,
not to keep them up. It was a strange sensation.
This is like swimming in space.
But I remember, I remember it because it was only a couple of weeks ago. But
good for you.
Thank you. But as you leave Jerusalem and head down into the Jericho Valley, there are all these sort of markers on the side of the road, like now leaving sea level. You're now at sea level. And you look down into that valley, the Jordan River Valley, and you're like, I'm at sea level now? This valley is really far down.
Well, I'm interested in, because I'm looking at what the runners up are, you know, because I assumed the Dead Sea was, you know, marginally lower than Death Valley and all these other endorheic basins. In fact, you know, after Death Valley, that's really it. You know, Death Valley is 400 meters below sea level. And then all the other low places, which are on every continent, Africa, Egypt, there's China, we got one in South America, here's one in Kazakhstan. You know, there's a bunch of these Death Valley. There's a bunch of these, and they're all, you know, they're all, a lot of them cluster around 150 meters below sea level. So there's a ton on every continent that are really low, and then there's Death Valley, which is almost three times lower than them. And I wonder what the reason for that is.
You just said that Death Valley was 400 meters below sea level.
No, I said the Dead Sea was
400. Oh, the Dead Sea. Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you said Death Valley.
No, the others all cluster kind of around 100 to 150 meters
yeah.
below sea level.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that if you are below sea level and anywhere near the sea will find you. It's one of the things about the sea.
It loves to find you.
The sea will find you.
But yeah, Salton Sea's in the top 10, I think. It's one of the 10 lowest places on Earth, but it's funny how these places are just scattered all over Egypt, Turkmenistan, Ethiopia, Argentina.
So the area of this Salton Sink, the what we think of as the Coachella and Imperial Valleys, they were that was a giant body of water as late as the Spanish era in Southern California.
No one expects the Spanish era in Southern California.
No one expects the Salton Sea to dry up in 1580, but it did.
Wow.
It continued to be a sort of seasonal lake until 1700, but because of the Colorado River's whimsy, it no longer periodically flowed into the sea, and after 1700, it was just a dry valley. Now, the interesting thing about it is that because over millions of years, the Colorado River deposited tremendous amounts of silt in the valley, mm-hmm. it is incredibly, it seems antithetical to the idea of a sun-baked desert for it also to have hundreds of feet of the most fertile soil.
Incredibly fertile topsoil.
Right. So it's...
It was topsoil that stole from...
It stole it from
other places upstream.
Yeah, from Colorado and Arizona. Oh, Arizona, famous for its topsoil.
Not anymore. It's not.
Well, the reason is because the Colorado River stole it. And so when settlers, white settlers, moved into Southern California and realized, you know, when it rained, all of a sudden this was incredible soil. Wait a minute. And it's sunny all the time. We could make this into fertile agricultural land.
Let's plant oranges.
That's what they did. And what they originally did was start to dig irrigation channels from the and we talked about this a lot in the Water Wars, all the old sort of rivers that flowed down into the Imperial Valley were channeled, and they practiced until not very long ago the flood style, the inundation style of irrigation, where they just open up the, it's not, you know, they weren't using sprinklers, in other words. They would open up the irrigation canals, the flood the land, and then the water would evaporate. But
sprinklers are more efficient because there's less evaporation. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. I mean, sprinklers, you can target the irrigation to when and where you need water, whereas flood irrigation is just like, we're just going to dump all this water on there and let it ride.
I see. So less of it goes to the specific plants in the beds.
Yeah, a lot of it.
Because it's just everywhere.
A lot of it evaporates. A lot of it sinks into the ground. As we'll see, that was also important to our friend, the Salton Sea. In the early 1900s, there was a lot of this kind of redirecting of rivers into canals, but those canals and those locks would very quickly fill up with silt. And so in trying to keep the water flowing there, using the primitive methods of the early 20th century, they kept kind of cutting new channels, different channels, cut, trying to keep the water flowing, and it would silt up again. And then in a very famous spring flood in 1905, the Colorado, suddenly full of water, and all these little channels away from it to steal water for the Imperial Valley.
Yeah.
The Colorado broke through and started just, and because the Colorado had over millions of years often redirected itself, it wasn't much of a stretch. And we're talking about this great basin where sometimes the distances between the area that has no outlet to the sea and a river that does flow to the sea, it's really not that great of a distance.
It's just one rise.
It's just, yeah, that's right. It's just a...
As the crow flies, it might just be, 20 miles away or something.
Yeah, amazing to think that the ocean is kept out of the Coachella Valley with earth that's only 30 feet high, right? The dam itself is... Yeah,
take that, the Netherlands.
It's only 30 feet above the ocean, and even...
So a lot of that place is below sea level. A lot of the Coachella Valley is below sea level.
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. And if just thinking about the global sea rise, I mean, for the seas to rise 30 feet, that will require a lot of ice cap melting. But
I think we can do it.
Yes.
We have a goal as a species to put an ocean in the Coachella Valley and return it to Earth by the end of this decade.
Decade.
Remember how Kennedy always said, of this decade? Why was he saying that? Did you know it used to be decadent instead of decadent, but then FDR made decadent catch on?
Oh, I prefer it. I prefer decadent.
Well, I do too, but I guess it's the same root as decay. So it was very natural to say decadent.
Oh, sure.
And I think FDR kind of changed America's minds about this.
Good job, FDR, and your mid-Atlantic accent.
He was busy with a lot of things, but one of them was making us say decadent wrong.
Decadent. Hmm.
You were not talking about that. Sorry.
No. It's on this show. Who knows?
You were talking about how little separates this Endorheic Basin from being just part of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, what happened in terms of the Colorado River breaking through what was a pretty small little, it didn't take much suggestion for the Colorado to think, oh, am I going back to my old friend, the Salton Sink?
Because there were already a river, there's probably a dry riverbed there.
And it almost immediately redirected its entire flow down a cliffside and into the Imperial and Coachella Valleys.
Which was, previously, this had probably happened many times over the millennia, but there weren't a bunch of farms and towns there? Like, was this place that now had human habitation?
Yeah, there was a railroad station. There was a salt mining,
I guess,
operation.
Operative word meaning was, right?
Yeah, the salt mining operation had its own small railroad, like a miniature salt mine railroad.
Those are cute.
There was a pretty large Indian reservation, the Torres Martinez Reservation, which even today, the reservation owns a lot of the land under the Salton Sea, and then it's cleaved into two hemispheres on either side.
Boy, that's a classic colonizer treaty, right? You can have this land that's just separated from the ocean by this very narrow berm.
Although,
good luck with that.
Although, you know, really good agricultural land, if
that's true,
responsibly.
You're really rolling the dice.
That's right. So the water of the Colorado, which is an enormous river, flowed almost entirely into this basin for a span of two straight years. And during that time, the genius engineers that had done this work, and also the admittedly genius engineers of the Southern Pacific Railroad, tried frantically to plug this hole, and everything they did just made it worse. You know, they would throw a bunch of dirt into the hole, and the river would just use that dirt to carve a deeper trench.
What am I picturing here? It didn't become, you know, I'm sure it didn't become 50 feet of standing water overnight. What it starts to seep in and evaporate, but you know, over the next few days and weeks, it just gets marshier and marshier. Is that what happened? It wasn't a wall of water, right?
Well, no, but it's pouring into
a salt mine,
a salt flat,
yeah,
right, which had been which knew what to do when covered with water, and mm-hmm. And probably in every sort of spring rain situation, that basin would have filled up and become a kind of blooming little home for migratory birds for a period, right? I mean, you see that in California all the time. A thing that's mostly desert then gets a flash of rain. I'm sure this spring in California was one of the most beautiful in recent memory because all those flowers bloom.
The wildflowers looked amazing.
The grass all comes up and it's this beautiful place.
I can attest.
And that's what would have traditionally happened here. But in this case, the water kept coming at the place where it came down the side of the mountain. A waterfall formed, and after the course of 2 years, it had gone from being this little 10-foot waterfall to being a waterfall 80 feet high, which was
tourist destination. That's nice,
amazing sight to see, and it became a very real concern that the Colorado that the torrent would erode its way back to the actual river course of the Colorado proper, at which point there'd be no way to undo it. The Colorado would just pour into the Salton Sea
forever.
You couldn't engineer a solution to it, or it'd be very hard to do. And downstream in the Colorado, I mean, not only was that a wetland, but also
were there people that used to use that water?
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, I mean, it was. This is the point in time when the Colorado did then go into Mexico and form a significant source of water for people in that part of that, you know, north of Baja,
yeah,
part of Mexico. That's not true even today, and I'll get to that in a second.
Foreshadowing.
I'm doing a little foreshadowing.
The podcaster's friend.
Dum, da, dum, dum, dum. It's podcaster's friend because you write things down on a piece of paper and you're like, wait a minute, why did I write that there? This is not a linear progression through time. This is just thoughts randomly put on a piece of paper.
Do you think podcasting is the only art form that maybe forgets to get back to the foreshadowing more often than it actually gets back to it?
Yes. I do.
That doesn't happen in The New Yorker much. They're never like, as we shall see, and then they forget to tell you.
They work hard at The New Yorker to read over their thing a few times before publishing.
They like to complete all those circles.
So into this basin, right, this basin fills up and becomes an enormous and quite charming lake. A lot of the fish of the Colorado River also flow into, you know, all the trout, and
they're happy there,
and they flow into the lake, and they're like, pretty chill for us.
I mean, I'm assuming it doesn't take long to, you know, totally change the vegetation around the lake. It's probably suddenly much lusher than it was.
Well, and it feels like this is also at a time when Hollywood and California are experiencing a huge influx of people and a lot of big excitement. This is where the money and the glitz goes from New York and Chicago.
What year did the floods start again?
The floods went from 1905 to 1907.
Yeah.
But you know, the movie
next decade or two, started there's a ton the next of decade. Money pouring in.
That's right. And so gradually at first the Salton Sea becomes, I mean, it's great for irrigating the farms around it. But also it becomes a kind of fishery. An exciting and profitable, productive fishery. It becomes a huge a place of migratory bird habitat.
Suddenly a freshwater lake appears.
That's right.
On their way to wherever they're going.
Develops a big pelican population, a lot of pelicans there.
The famous pelicans of Southern California.
That's right. And you know, tens of thousands of pelicans. But it becomes very quickly a place of recreation. People from Southern California start to go there, you know, at first to fish, but then later to boat. It was, interestingly, for much of its time, it was a place where people raced boats because the low elevation meant that carbureted motors could run a kind of richer mix.
Oh, was this a thing where you could get better water speed records here than anywhere else on Earth?
Yeah, it was considered kind of unfair. All the records that were set at the Salton Sea were unfair or were, you know, there was controversy about whether they should be accepted as as race results.
Real turmoil in the water speed record world.
That's right.
Of the teens and 20s. I mean, I can say just from having lived in the Great Basin how the culture around these damned lakes like Mead and not these damned lakes, but these damned lakes like Lake Mead and Lake Powell, like it really becomes the center of people's calendars almost. Like, okay, every summer we go to Lake Powell or Lake Mead or whatever it is, you know, and I can, that's interesting that happened in Southern California.
Yeah, really. I mean, and Southern California has quite a few, like Lake Arrowhead is also a created environment. There was a lot of, well, we did a whole episode on the California's aggressive management and theft of water from one place
What's
to another.
What's the word? Theft.
As early as 1930, it was declared, portions of the Salton Sea were declared a wildlife refuge, and it continued to be kind of a sink where water would, you know, seasonally flood into the Salton Sea. So the levels of the lake were, it was not evaporating so fast that the lake was diminishing. And then all of the water that was then again used to irrigate the farms of the Imperial and Coachella Valleys, because they were using flooding irrigation, well, there was a tremendous amount of runoff, and all that runoff would go down the valley and replenish the Salton Sea. Now, as we'll see, it was also bringing with it fertilizer and all the salts and dissolved minerals of the land that had formerly been an ocean. So it was concentrating salt and minerals as the water went downhill. But the lake was then seeded with sport fish. Mm-hmm. The four main sport fish were the orange mouth corvina, which were kind of the primary sport fish. They were really pretty big fish and fun to catch and delicious, but also the sargo, the gulf croaker, and ultimately the tilapia.
The first three were like fake fish from a Wes Anderson movie to me, but then you got to the tilapia and I was back on board.
That's right. The orange mouth corvina and the gulf croaker are all completely fish.
Just made up.
And the sargo, completely fake fish. But at one point, the Salton Sea was California's most productive fishery.
Huh.
The kind of fishery where you would throw your line in the water and it was just a feeding frenzy, you know, like the water would boil with fish. But then the construction of the Hoover Dam ended the periodic intermittent flooding of the valley because the Hoover Dam could control floodwaters. And then the Imperial Dam was basically it impounded the silt behind it. So, you know, the waterworks of the early 1930s, and I don't mean the boo-hoo waterworks. I mean...
You're not talking about a Barbara Stanwyck movie.
No, sirree. I'm talking about all of the Depression era big, big projects that really changed the way water was manipulated in that area, changed the way water went into the Salton Sea. And one of the big tricks was the All-American Canal. The All-American Canal is a canal that was built to divert the Colorado River water so that it never goes into Mexico.
Oh, I see. I mean, I thought it was tooting its own horn a bit with that name, but now I see that it deserves its jingoistic name.
Yeah, the All-American Canal turns the Colorado River water literally at the border.
Like it's like it makes a 90-degree turn?
It does. It does, and it proceeds right along the border, just tantalizingly along the border. It's the biggest dick move maybe in all of history. I mean, there have been a lot of those, like damming the Nile and damming the Euphrates.
But this one seems like, was it an international incident? Or did the U.S. have so much hemispheric power that Mexico just kind of had to roll over?
It's still an international incident. I mean, it dried up the delta. All of the people that survived down there had no water. All the birds and all the sea life that depended on it, all gone. It's a real water steal. And it changed the whole nature of that region. It's the largest canal on Earth. It has 26,000 cubic feet of water per second.
Wow.
Going through it. And it's also been called America's most dangerous waterway because over 500 people have drowned in it because it's right along the U.S.-Mexican border.
Crossing. I see.
So people jump over. It looks like a swimmable little stretch of water, but you get in it. It's super cold and it's moving super fast and people die. So as late as the late 60s, this Salton Sea became a huge tourist destination. They built whole towns, resort towns. It was the site of some of the best Googie architecture on the planet. These little, tropical themed motels and
we've done a whole omnibus on them.
Yeah,
and this is the new adoption of the automobile. So suddenly there's this new class of tens of millions of people maybe that are looking for family vacation destinations who would not have been able to.
Yeah. At its previous decade, I think 1.5 million people visited in a year. Wow. It typically had 500,000 visitors.
Wow.
And it had big, big shows. It was like a favorite place for Sinatra to play. I think pretty much every headlining entertainer at the time, after their Vegas show, stopped by the Salton Sea to put on a big, there were ballrooms. There were whole towns, Bombay Beach, Desert Shores, and this was also luau culture, barbecue culture, water ski culture. It all combined, and the Salton Sea was really the playground of it.
We need a movie set there.
There are movies set there.
But like from the time, right?
There are movies of the time, but there's also like a Vincent D'Onofrio movie called Salton Sea?
I've never even heard of that.
I feel like that's a movie that you and I should watch in our omnibus film festival.
That we just invented? It's a noir crime.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, but it's not a period piece. It's not set back then. It's
set in the decaying ruins?
I think it's a gloomy meth-themed noir that has maybe a third act out by the lake.
Well, so a combination of factors that we will call a perfect storm, because in some ways it involves a perfect storm, started to make the Salton Sea a less desirable place. And the fertilizers and the heavy metals and the pollution that were all washing down into it from agricultural runoff started to create algae blooms. Mm. And in fact, the tilapia in the lake were originally introduced into the canals as algae-eating
superfish. Are they bottom feeders?
Yeah, and they were meant to clean the algae out of the canals. The millions and millions of tilapia that are in or that were in the Salton Sea apparently all descended from a very small number of algae control fish that washed down in from, you know, this is the classic introduced species problem.
Was there a real reproductive fitness problem? You're getting too many incestuous tilapia? Three-eyed tilapia?
Seems like the tilapia,
they were okay marrying their cousins?
If you buy tilapia in a restaurant in Los Angeles, there's maybe still a good chance that it got fished out of the Salton Sea. Although there have been...
They can handle what it's become. Interesting.
Well, until recently, right? They were able to eat or able to survive in this kind of extremely saline water because eventually the Salton Sea became more, had a greater salinity than the Pacific Ocean. So it became a real concentration of heavy metals and salt.
Oof.
And then there were some big floods. A couple of tropical storms in the 70s actually did what this most recent set of tropical storms did and just inundated the area with water and kind of flooded the towns and trashed the resorts. The opposite of what we think of as Salton Sea problems, it actually had too much water and it sort of wrecked the communities that were already, it was already kind of starting to wane there on when the water levels were low. It started to stink.
I was going to ask that exact question because I used to live in Salt Lake City and that can happen.
The lake would sink or stink.
It would. Yes.
It would sink and stink.
It is sinking. And the more it sinks, the more it stinks.
Well, after the late 70s, there was a Hurricane Kathleen that kind of hit the area pretty hard, and there wasn't as much energy to rebuild as there had been before because it had already started to take on a reputation as kind of a stinky, decaying lake.
Anyway, as a vacation spot, once the cool place to go becomes the down-on-its-luck place to go, that's kind of a hard corner to turn back.
Yeah, and it wasn't helped by a kind of a tone of scientific hyperventilation about what was happening there. There was a lot of hyperbole around the idea that the Salton Sea was drying up and was going to be an environmental catastrophe.
What's the era here? It's like
the 80s now.
Okay.
And although not untrue, the hyperbole also contributed to people feeling like it was a fait accompli or that it had already happened. The Salton Sea had become a polluted and unusable place, and so that also killed tourism. What are you opening over there?
I'm quietly opening the mail.
Why are you doing that?
Because then I'll be ready to go at the end of the show.
Oh, it's audible on the show. Yes, all the opening of mail.
That's good.
It sounds like a co-host that isn't paying full attention to what is being
said. I think you don't care about the audio quality. You feel like I cannot listen to a story about the Salton Sea and slowly tear open a package with my hands.
Well, when you do your next show, what if I just do this during it and we'll see how you feel?
It's good. It's like a crackling fire.
Oh, it is kind of.
It's a homey feeling.
So relaxing. It does show up on the feed. I'll stop talking for a second.
You think that's how they did? You think that's how they did fire, like crackling fire on old timey radio?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
We needed one of those big pieces of metal they would do to do thunder. Why does it have a bell?
What's the sound of thunder?
Why does the thunder have a bell?
In fact, the smell became sometimes noticeable in Los Angeles,
which is very far away.
At one point, there. In a kind of freak occurrence, the algae blooms then became a source of botulism that killed a bunch of tilapia, which were then preyed upon by the pelicans. And in one incident, 10,000 pelicans died of botulism.
Because they ate bad tilapia?
They ate bad tilapia.
And I assume this is when they stopped serving the tilapia at restaurants?
Well, I think you can still get tilapia at restaurants, but they stopped serving tilapia
this
that
tilapia.
Had washed up on the shore.
Oh, I see.
And
those pelicans were just lazy.
If you think of how big a pelican is, and then you think of 10,000 dead pelicans, which is a great band name, but a terrible environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, that's not going to help the smell.
They actually had to erect incinerators and burn the pelicans for days and days and days just to get them out of there. And so the Salton Sea gradually evaporated and got more and more saline and less hospitable.
So the water is still coming in, but less because of dams upstream.
Well, water isn't really coming in anymore.
It's all been diverted to irrigation.
Yeah, well, or diverted to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
All the water from the All American Canal. I mean, all this stuff. So within the water wars that are happening at this time in Southern California, there is this incredible tension between agriculture and urbanity, or urbanism,
mm-hmm.
and the negotiations are all about who gets the water. No one is putting any water into the Salton Sea. And
who speaks for the pelicans?
Who speaks for the pelicans? But what really happened was until the late 90s, the Salton Sea survived and mostly was replenished with this flood irrigation runoff. And although it brought a lot of pollution and salt with it, there still was a lot of water being introduced to the farmlands. In the late 90s, most of those Imperial Valley farms switched from flood irrigation to sprinkler irrigation. And all of a sudden, what had been counted, and they did that to preserve water. It was heralded as a water conservation
method. It's more efficient. You get more crops per drops.
But what it did was completely cut off what had been the only source of water other than, you know, periodic, sporadic rainfall.
Occasional rain.
That kept the lake up. And so starting in the year 2000, in the late 90s, it was recognized that if something isn't done, the lake will disappear, and that will be bad. Because as the lake recedes, the lake bottom now, it becomes, in the wind of the region, a very windy region, becomes a kind of granular, a very coarse but also very fine particulate. So coarse sand, but very fine micro particulate of PCBs and heavy metals and garbage, so much so that 20% of the kids in the region have asthma. So it's such a catastrophe for the children of the region, 80+% of whom are Latino.
These are rural kids?
Yeah. These are all farming communities right around there. And so they actually have a system in the schools, a like colored flag system where
tells you if it's safe to breathe that day.
Yeah, on a green flag day, you can go out and play, but on a yellow flag day, you should only walk outside sparingly, and on a red flag day, you just don't go outside.
I mean, this is the future Salt Lake City is terrified of, because if that lake dries up, it's the same problem. It's a lake bed full of heavy metals and other gross stuff. And
does the prevailing wind blow toward south or to Salt Lake?
That's an interesting question. I feel like no, because you can tell when the wind is coming from the lake. But, you know, it would, you know, that's a huge population center right there, which is maybe not true of the Salton Sea.
Yeah. And although, you know, up not very far. I mean, like I say, the whole valley is only 100 miles long. Coachella and then Palm Springs and Desert Springs and all those burgeoning rich people enclaves.
They could be affected by the
wind,
asthma winds.
The wind comes the other way into those valleys, but the wind seems to blow from, you know, up from the Gulf of Mexico. So there's got to be a perfect point in the middle where you're getting wind from both sides. And that is where to buy real estate now. Sonny Bono, former mayor of Palm Springs, lobbied to protect the Salton Sea, and there was a law passed by Bill Clinton, the Salton Sea Reclamation Act. There's an authority, like a multi-agency authority called the Salton Sea Authority, but they all have the same problem, which is the only way to save the Salton Sea is to put water in it. And the only way to put water in it is to take water from two demographics that are already at war over water.
They're at the bottom of the water totem pole.
It's the city of Los Angeles, the city of San Diego, versus all of the farmers that are growing alfalfa for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Because, I mean, a lot of the produce from those markets is exported. It's where the Imperial and Coachella Valleys like to present themselves as America's breadbasket, but a lot of that
was that hypothetical. It's really alfalfa.
Well, there's a lot of hay going
to feed Saudi princes' horses.
There's a lot of hay that are going to camel beauty contests and whatnot. You know, being sold out on the open market in two countries similarly desertified, but without the Colorado River. So the Salton Sea is always going to be at a disadvantage. The fisheries started to really collapse in about 2000.
Oh, it's pretty recent.
Yeah. You could still fish there quite comfortably through the 90s. But the Corvina, the Sargo, and the Croaker all
croaked,
and leaving the tilapia, which were able to survive in the saline water. The tilapia then proliferated into the billions. And when I visited the Salton Sea in the early 2010s, there were still a lot of tilapia there, but the shores were lined. I mean, actually absolutely coated with tilapia skeletons. Everywhere you went, it was just like you were just walking on.
Are seagulls just circling eating them?
Well,
or are they
pelicans?
Yeah, still pelicans.
The wind was blowing. We were scoured by sand and terrible.
Yeah, you have six kinds of cancer now.
Cancers. And with the death of all of the fish, because I think since I was there, even the tilapia population has collapsed. The problem with that, of course, is that all those fish were eating all the mosquito larvae that kept it from being like an absolute nightmare of a place. And now I think the reports are that the mosquito are...
The biblical plagues are coming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's super American. This is not front page news because it's in a place nobody cares about. If this were Tahoe.
If you go there now, because Slab City and Salvation Mountain and all these kooky, quirky places are out there. There are still in the wreckage of the town of Bombay Beach. You go there and it truly is a apocalypse, but there are still some bars and old motels that
just catering to these kind of seasonal itinerant.
No, that have been colonized by art, weirdos and just like end of the roaders. So I spent an afternoon in a bar there that felt like the end of the road.
You're in a Mad Max movie.
Could not get further. You could not get closer to the end of the road. And there's always going to be somebody that wants to get far enough away, even if it includes going to a wind-scorched, PCB-laden, mosquito-infested, apocalyptic hellscape. So there will always be someone there spray-painting their tags. What seems to be the future, there have been some proposals to actually bring seawater into the region because it's on, excuse me.
You're using the, do not gesture with the bell.
It's because it's on the San Andreas Fault, there's a lot of geothermal energy, mud, volcanoes, and hot underground gases that in the most ambitious schemes could power desalination plants that if you piped seawater into the Salton Sea, you could desalinate it with geothermal energy.
I mean, that's interesting because that's always the knock on desalinization is it's so inefficient. It's such an energy suck.
Right.
But if you were just getting the energy out of the ground, like Iceland.
Right. The energy that's right there, you could conceivably do it. Although someone very ambitious, hello, Elon Musk, would need to take the, you know, create energy around the idea that, hey, we're going to use four different new technologies, geothermal energy, desalination, seawater shipment, you know, in order to recreate this fantastic environment that right now has no advocates. No one is interested. It's really an environmental catastrophe we'd be trying to avert.
It seems like a long shot, though.
It's a lot to do.
Because all these technologies will probably be perfected in places where they're profitable.
Right. Like Israel.
Yeah, for example. Yeah. Or maybe desalination comes to San Diego before it comes to the Imperial Valley.
Yeah.
And maybe by the time they're all up and running and you can start to see a possibility, maybe it's too late for
the
Salton Sea.
The case would probably be to recreate the incredibly verdant farm country that could be there if we had unlimited water.
Yeah.
To bring water up from the Gulf of Mexico through a geothermal powered desalination universe. I mean, you could see that case being made.
You just make it part of the ocean? What would it take to actually connect it to the Gulf of California?
All you have to do is knock down this 30-foot wall of silt that keeps the ocean out, but I don't know if anybody really wants it to be a sea. That would be a very ambitious idea.
It's not ideal, but it does seem better than a stinky, chemical-ridden, mosquito-infesting lake bed.
Yeah, I think it would. I think the catastrophe of it would have to amplify to the point that in L.A., all you smelled was dead tilapia and dead pelicans, for somebody to say, like, you know what, let's open this back up to the ocean. And also, I mean, that would complicate the All-American Canal. The very interesting thing is that with the rise of lithium as a massive commodity.
For batteries,
which is, you know, fairly recent, where lithium has become a global super commodity. There's lithium to be mined in the Salton Sink, again, as a result of this geothermal mud surge of lithium.
This is not stuff that flowed down the Colorado River. It's been there all along.
This is lithium that's coming up from the ground. And no less than General Motors has just recently broken ground on a giant lithium extraction facility there in the Salton Sink.
For car batteries.
So that's right. So now the return the Salton Sea to the ocean or recreate a freshwater Frank Sinatra playground is now in competition with General Motors wanting to make clean powered automobiles. Which one of these environmental movements is going to succeed and turn this mosquito mudflat into like the future of humanity?
The terrible thing about I mean, one of the bad things about the green movement is you can now think of General Motors opening a mine in a in a natural site as a victory for the environment.
That's right.
Because this is going to make pickup trucks that are that don't burn gas.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
At least, you know, they'll probably burn coal at some power plant somewhere. But
pickup trucks that we can use to take all the dead pelicans to the incinerator.
Somebody's going to have to do it.
The one interesting footnote here is that with the death of the tilapia, the only fish that can survive in this whole ecosystem of canals and silt and salt-filled dying aquifers.
Yeah.
Is the desert pupfish.
No way. The from our previous The Devil's Hole Death Valley guy?
The Devil's Hole pupfish is a, is just a sub-community of the larger community of pupfish that live in the whole desert. And desert pupfish are used to surviving in a very wide spectrum of salinities and water temperatures.
It changes all year.
Yeah, and sometimes the water's hot, sometimes it's cold, and that would kill most fish, but the pupfish survive.
That would be great if this ecological disaster turns out to be, you know, the animal with the smallest ecosystem, the Devil's Hole pupfish, if it can move next door and take over this enormous dying lake. It'd be a dream come true for somebody. There goes the neighborhood. And that concludes the Salton Sea. Entry 1098.GN1403, certificate number 44008, in the omnibus. Futurelings, we were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, on social media at Omnibus Project Jointly, products of our time. Elon Musk does not seem to be interested in reviving wetlands. He's too interested in making Twitter awesome.
Yes, he has done that. I would just love it if Elon Musk subscribed to our Patreon at $1,000 a month.
Patreon.com/omnibusproject is where you can support the show. If you've thought of, we've had a bit of subscriber fatigue lately. We could use some new blood.
It's been true, I think, across all subscriber-based systems. People get tired of eels, but also I think when the economy goes down a little bit, people reduce their subscription from $20 a month to $5. And
I guess there may be some just culture-wide thing where the subscription model hit a point where, you know, there's more options than ever and you've been doing it for long enough that you're not excited about it anymore. Like, it could actually be a big ticking clock for everyone.
I think with every studio, every television studio or either combining or coming up with new ways to suck blood from you, you have to look at the end of the month and go, well, I did watch Netflix a lot, so that's worth, how much does Netflix cost?
I can't remember.
15 bucks, let's call it. And then I'm giving $5 to these 10 podcasts each. Which one am I going to cut back on? Netflix? Hardly, sir. So it's tough all over. And at a certain point, you're going to want, like here in Seattle, I want all the museums to be on one card. I will pay $100 a year for one card that gets me into every museum. But instead,
it's pretty insane that you have to pay $50 a year to go to one museum.
Yeah.
Because how many times a year do you go to each museum?
The EMP, the Airplane Museum, the MOHAI, the Seattle Art Museum, they should all be on one card. And I think if you and I started a company that was One Card Seattle, and we went to all those places and we made a deal with them, we could probably make $30,000 to $40,000 each a year.
I feel like they have them for tourists, but you have to go to all the museums like in a three-day period.
Yeah,
or something.
Screw that.
And then you have to go to Salty's or something. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com to complain about this or any entry in the omnibus.
Don't complain about this
entry. You can only complain if you donate. First, go to the Patreon and support the show. Then do your worst.
I feel like somebody's going to write and go, Water Wars, Slab City, Desert Pupfish. This episode is just three other episodes.
We've done 555 shows. If you do a show touching on that area once every 180 shows, you're going to get three of them by this time.
Hey, there you go.
That's my take on it, by the way, John.
Wait till you hear my show, All the Girls I've Dated That Live in Joshua Tree Now.
Is that more? Is it more than
it's
one?
It's going to be a 2.5 hour show.
Do they all hang out together?
No, they don't know each other at all. God, why would I?
Until they listen to the show, then they will.
They're going to write me and go, "Who? Who else?"
You could send us physical items to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155, which I will then open slowly, but not entirely soundlessly.
No, I'm gonna rattle something through your whole next show. See
this,
how you like it.
This turned out to be a note from Steve, who sent us a copy of the Pocket, Thomas J. Glover's book, Pocket Reference.
Oh, you were going to say Pocket Pool.
He bought... He bought copies for his twin nephews one Christmas because they're all polymathic nerds. I actually have a copy of this book. Do you have a copy of this book?
I don't. I have some really cool pocket world atlases, but let me see that.
It's fun. Do you want to know the tensile strength of various diameters of different materials of rope? Polypropylene fiber. He lists some of the facts we will learn therein. For example, what the phone number is for the Hudson Valley in New York.
Oh, this is smart.
What the length of a cubit was in ancient Assyria.
Airline toll-free numbers. How long do you think that will be?
I still sometimes call airline toll-free numbers.
Standard dry torque for coarse threaded non-ferrous and stainless steel bolts.
How to get how to convert a tropical Becquerel year to a sidereal day.
Aluminum wire amp capacity.
It's extremely industrial. The melting point of a red lumber crayon. I don't know why you would be putting that in your kiln, but in case you did, it melts at 597 degrees Kelvin. That's a sturdy crayon, John.
It is. Here's the density and melting points of all metals, alloys, and elements.
Thank you, Steve, for sending that along. I have one on my shelf at home, and now John has one as well, and we can call each other on our toll-free numbers and commiserate.
I will carry this now around my neck on a chain.
Find your fellow futurelings online, wherever futurelings are sold, by looking up that word on Reddit or Facebook or various other fora, and complain to them.
Yeah, complain to them.
And then not to us.
Complain to them, complain to us, and see which one fills up faster. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, and if it does come, that it doesn't smell like dead pelicans. If the worst does come soon, however, this recording, like all our recordings, will be buried under 1,000 feet of silty mud. And, in that case, will have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.